This thing on? Okay, good. I think we got sound. All right. Well, it's good to be back in class. I think I've been gone for 3 Sundays, but I got to see a whole bunch of you up in Oregon. Last count, I think there were 10 and maybe more of you that were up there watching the total solar eclipse. Especially grateful for Ross Hoagland and all the greeters. If you're wondering why there weren't greeters, they're not here today. So, but all of them were up at the eclipse, so that was fun. And it actually really helped Kathy and me because, you know, I've been traveling a lot and got back and realized that driving up to Oregon was not an option. I had too many responsibilities here, so we had to fly up. We literally got the last flight that was available to go to Oregon. We had to fly into Eugene. There were no cars to rent in Oregon, but we had a relative in Eugene. We borrowed their car. So that's how we got to the eclipse. But it's thanks to Ross and all the greeters that all of our telescopes got up, because they were anticipating that the church van would be filled with people. It wasn't, but that left room for the telescopes. So he says, fine, because I was going to drive all the telescopes up. Couldn't do it. Gave them to Ross and the greeters. They got them up and got them back. We actually had 6 telescopes set up desert of Oregon. So what I'm going to do is tell you a little bit about what happened when I was back in Virginia Beach, because that actually was a crucial setup for the eclipse. Talk a little bit about the eclipse. Then I'm going to invite some of the class members who were actually there to give their report. And they don't know this. I'm going to quiz them. Okay? All right. So should be fun. And whatever time we got left, we're going to get into Ecclesiastes chapter 9. We got started on it last time I was here. Let's see if we can actually get that finished. So, but yeah, one of the Sundays I was gone, I was in Virginia Beach at Regent University. And I found out it's the fastest growing Christian university literally in the world. They just passed 10,000 students, and they said they'll be past 11,000 students come early October. And just a year ago when I was there, they were at 7,000 students. So it gives you an idea how rapidly they're growing. And the good news is they want to partner with Reasons to Believe. And so I was up there giving a series of lectures, and they had the principal faculty attend those lectures. I got to have breakfast and lunch with them every day. And so basically we were able to hammer out, we thought, a good partnership would be. And, you know, one of the things that's happened with Christian universities that have decided to launch a science program is that they typically begin by having a lot of young Earth constituents, but once they start teaching science, that goes away, but then they go into theistic evolution and liberal theology. And Regent does not want to go that way, but we said that's been the pattern of every university that's launched a bachelor's of science program. And so basically the strategy working out is for their faculty to actually be assigned by them to spend time with us as visiting scholars at Reasons to Believe, where we get to expose them to evangelizing their peers. Because basically I was able to explain to them the reason why you see this drift towards liberal theology and theistic evolution is the professors at these Christian universities lose the opportunity to evangelize their secular peers. And so what we're trying to work out is a way for them to get that kind of exposure while they're part of the faculty of a Regent. We're still working things out, but that's kind of where we want to go. They seem very receptive to the idea, and so we'll see what happens. But it'd be great if we could actually see a Christian university launch a significant science program without seeing that kind of a theological drift. So we'll see what happens.
Is there any university like that, Tom?
Well, the one university I know that's been able to avoid that drift, I don't know where they are now, but I was there 20 years ago. It was a Seattle Pacific University, and they required all of their science faculty to be involved in research with secular peers at the University of Washington. And so there they got to actually engage scientists in their own discipline that were not believers. And, they were challenged to have a significant impact. And at least at that time, I don't know what's going on at Seattle Pacific today. But when I did speak there, I noticed that the faculty there had a very different attitude than what I'd seen at other Christian universities. So in a sense, we're kind of copying the same idea, finding some way to have these, and also to get them into the scientific literature. Because often what happens with Christian professors, you know, Christians who are science professors at Christian universities, the focus is on teaching. They're not reading the scientific literature, or if they are, they're not reading it much in depth, and they're not having the opportunity to engage their secular peers and challenge them to become Christians. So our goal is to make them evangelists. It was interesting because I've been to these other universities saying, well, we are evangelists, but the only evangelism is happening, they're evangelizing the non-Christian students that come to their campus. And so we talked about that, and I was a region, I says, recognize the selection effect. Students who enroll at a Christian university have a pretty good idea what they're in for. And so they're typically very receptive to Christianity to start with. It really isn't the same as evangelizing people who are not, quote, purposely enrolling at a Christian university. And also there's a difference when you have a professor talking to a student as opposed to a professor talking to a professor. There is a distinct difference. And so evangelism needs to be much broader than simply evangelizing non-Christian undergraduates that happen to enroll on your campus. You know, what about getting involved on other campuses that are not Christian? So,
well, I was just thinking of Iola and Talbot because they have William Lake Craig, but maybe they're not in the pattern you're advocating.
Well, you know, we're also dialoguing with Iola because they're wanting to launch a science program as well. You know, and the big challenge is that, at least with Regent, they've made a commitment not to appease the young Earth creationists, whereas Biola is still struggling, trying to balance that. But, you know, we've been talking to them saying, if you're serious about launching a science curriculum, and they are, I said, just look at all the other Christian universities that have done that. If you wait enough time, the young Earth issue ceases to be an issue. So, you know, basically, don't sweat that. But, of course, Biola is in this position where a lot of their support base are young Earth creationists. So, but, you know, there's a way to appeal to those folks without being abrasive. And a lot of my old Earth creationist apologists, they tend to be very abrasive towards their young Earth friends. And that doesn't help. So I think there is a way that, you know, an institution like Biola can make headway. And they're interested. So we'll see. And something for you to be praying about as we try to partner with both Regent and Biola. So, but while I was there, the media department at Christian Broadcasting Network, which actually shares the same campus as Regent University, said, do you have time to break away from your lectures and do some news spots? And I said, sure, I'll come over. They didn't even tell me what they wanted to talk about. I basically showed up, and they said... I said, well, what do you want to interview me about? And they said, well, how about the coming eclipse? I said, are you ready? I said, yeah, I can do that. So I said, we're actually going to the eclipse. So they didn't even know that we were taking a group to the eclipse or that we were having an eclipse conference. So when they found out, they got all excited. Well, if you go to the Christian Broadcasting Network website, you'll see they've done quite a bit on this past eclipse, including interviewing astronomers who are not Christians about the eclipse. And basically contrasting my beliefs with this astronomer at, I think it was Georgetown University. And her comment is, well, yeah, Dr. Ross speaks about how this is a perfect solar eclipse. I think that's just a pure coincidence. So now, if you were at the conference we had, we explained why it couldn't be just a coincidence. I mean, that's all you look at. You might think, well, that's maybe just a sheer coincidence. But there's a lot more that lines up with that perfect solar eclipse. We'll talk about that in a minute. But yeah, I wound up doing, probably 8 or 9 interviews on the solar eclipse. Incidentally, this is the 4th time I've tried to see a solar eclipse. The 3 previous times, it got rained out. I mean, that happens when you live in the Pacific Northwest. In fact, there was one time where I was 16 years of age, and I was the director of observations for the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, Vancouver chapter, and we had over 60 people ready to go see this total solar eclipse just south of the Canadian border, and it poured rain all day. So, and a few of our people actually went there in spite of the pouring rain, and they said, it looks just like a heavy rainstorm in Vancouver, because, you know, I've been in these heavy rainstorms. It literally gets so dark, it feels like it's nighttime. That's how heavy the rain can get in the coastal British Columbia. And they said the eclipse was the same, so it's like, big deal. So that was my most serious attempt. But then there were others, and likewise. So this is the first time I actually got to see a total solar eclipse where we could actually see the sun and the moon. Pretty amazing. So, but what's also fun is, oh, I should tell you a bit how it got organized. Because, you know, one of our astronomers, Jeff Swearing, his parents happened to have a home that's right at the center of the eclipse path, you know, not far from St. Joseph, Missouri. And they said, no, I want, you know, they have a 30, and they organized all our neighbors. We're going to do the conference there. But then we looked at the possibility of cloud cover. It was significant in that area. So we said, we got to find some place where we got, because if we're going to bring a whole bunch of people, we want them to have at least more than a 50% probability they're going to see something. So I figured, well, Eastern Oregon has got the highest probability of clear skies. And so we got out a map, and we found out that there was a Christian camp that was just 5 miles from the center line in eastern Oregon. It was a Young Life camp called the Washington Family Camp. So we called them on the phone, and they said, could we bring a group? Well, I mean, they process 9,000 students a week. So we figured they got to, maybe they'll have room for us. And they said, we're actually shutting the camp down on August 20th. And I said, well, can we talk into keeping it open a few more days? And they said, why? Because there's a total solar eclipse. They had no idea that they were on the total solar eclipse path. And so they said, well, let's see what we can do. So they arranged to keep the camp open. You want to know why? Because their fundraiser said, you know what? Reasons to Believe is going to have a conference there. How about if we reserve 40 places? So we weren't the only group there. I mean, we had 150 spots, and we filled them all. And, you know, we were wondering if we could even fill, because the camp says, look, if all you're going to bring is 20 or 30 people, we're not sure we can do this. And so we basically made an announcement to our constituency. Within 36 hours, all 150 spots were filled. It filled up that fast.
How long ago did you talk onto that?
We talked to that camp about it was about 6 or 7 months ago.
That recently?
So, yeah, and they had no idea they were on the total solar eclipse path. But, yeah, I mean, we actually had to cut off the wait list. Believe it or not, we had more than 300 people on the wait list. And we said, well, you know, even if all 150 canceled, that's only going to be able to accommodate half of you. So we actually cut it off. But we probably could have taken 500 people, and the camp could have accommodated that many, but they said they didn't have the staff, because a lot of their staff leave after the students go back to school. So they basically had a skeleton crew there. They said, we can take 150. Well, the reason why they said yes, their fundraiser said to the Young Life people, how about if we tell people we're on the total solar eclipse path, and you know, Reasons to Believe is bringing 150. If we bring 40, that will fill up one of the main residence buildings, and we can, you know, we're going to have to staff that anyway. And so they told us, because we wanted the full place. Could you please give us all 200 places? They said, no, you got 150, because we're going to reserve the rest for a group. Well, you know what they did? They basically told their support base, we got 40 openings to see the total solar eclipse in our path. The 40 highest bidders get it. Well, I talked to that fundraiser. They raised $40,000. And they said, what did you guys do? And they said, well, we basically set it at cost. They said, well, how's Reasons to Believe going to survive if you keep setting everything at cost? But see, we had a different objective. We wanted families to be able to come. And if we had done what they did, we would have only had adults without children showing up. Those that got two incomes and no kids, they could afford that kind of thing. But we wanted the families to come.
Did they feed you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can't believe how inexpensive it was, because they basically gave us a place to stay and took care of all of our meals. And they also gave us access to all the recreation facilities, which are pretty spectacular. I mean, if you're going to entertain high school kids, you got to have... I mean, they had a water park there that is superior to the water park in San Dimas. So, and they had these zip lines. I had to work on my next book, so I didn't get to do all that stuff. But Kathy took advantage of it all. So she actually loved the zip lines, where they had these zip lines up on the mountain, and you get to go down the zip line, and you know how they slow you down? You go right into their lake, and the lake water slows you down. So she thought that was great. She went on the go-karts, and you know, there's a miniature golf course that's in an air-conditioned building. I mean, they had a tournament for ping pong and other things. So, and you know what they had me do for recreation? I had to guide people up this really steep hill, because they were saying, you know, some of your people are going to want to watch the eclipse from what they call Communication Hill. Well, after I took them up there, they basically said, we're not going.
Because you could see the panorama, right?
Oh, it was a beautiful spot. However, and it was short. I mean, you could go up there, and I mean, it took me 11 minutes just to get up there, but some people, it took them 40 minutes to get up. Why? There's one spot where it's 45 degrees, and probably the gentlest is 30. I thought, there's no switchbacks. It just goes straight up the hill. And it's hot there, so you get pretty thirsty by the time you get to the top. So,
Dragon telescopes up there wouldn't be proud.
Well, we were thinking at Dragon Telescope. I couldn't find any volunteers. Now, the one volunteer I did try to snag, Tim's in the class here somewhere, isn't he? Where's Tim? There's Tim. I tried to talk Tim into it. But I went up there twice, and Tim was up there with me the first day. And he said, okay, I'm not taking a 70-pound telescope up there. Because I volunteered to take the 40-pound mount up if Tim would take the 70-pound telescope that fits on top of it. And he basically said, hey, I'm 22 years of age, but I'm not. No, that's not going to work. So he kept the telescopes at the bottom. And actually, what happened is there was one guy, this is his fifth solar eclipse. And unlike me, he didn't go to rainy places. He went to Egypt, he went to Turkey, and you know, he's literally traveled around the world. And you know what? He gave a talk where he basically said, once you've seen a total solar eclipse, it's addictive. And Tim, this was what, your 11th?
12 total and 4 annular, I think. Yeah.
He's seen 12 solar eclipses and 4 annular. In fact, I'm going to have Tim actually explain to you. Can you just briefly explain the difference between an annular solar eclipse and a total solar eclipse?
Yeah, the total solar eclipse is when the moon completely covers over the sun and completely covers over the photosphere, so you don't get the bright disk of the sun. And that happens when the moon is nearer to the Earth at its nearest apogee point, and ideally when the Earth is at the aphelion, the perigee point, and the Earth is at the aphelion point, so that the Sun is the smallest angular diameter, the Moon is the largest, then you get the longest total solar eclipse, which is about 7 minutes long. So it takes that, the Moon is that much bigger that it takes just that much time to pass over the photosphere. When you have the you have them exactly the same time, you'll just have a momentary total eclipse. Going at the other extreme, where the moon is furthest from the Earth and the sun is nearest, you'll have a ring eclipse or an annular eclipse, where the moon isn't quite big enough to cover the sun. It's still a partial eclipse in that case, but it's beautiful that you can see this nice ring of photosphere around it. And that's also a worthwhile thing to travel to see. I haven't traveled as far to see annular eclipses as I have total, because the total is really where it's at as far as eclipses.
It really is, but you know, what he's talking about is that as the moon orbits around the Earth, it's an elliptical orbit. So sometimes it's closer to the Earth and sometimes farther away. And about a quarter to one-third of all solar eclipses are annular, where the moon doesn't perfectly cover the disk of the sun. So, but the one we were at was about 2 minutes. And there's a big advantage in seeing one that's shorter than 2 minutes. Because when it's shorter than 2 minutes, you've got the disk of the moon almost exactly equal to the disk of the sun in the sky. And when that happens, you see the greatest exposure of the atmosphere of the sun, and especially the corona of the sun. Because a lot of people that were part of our group said, it didn't get completely dark. And I said, that's because it's a very short total solar eclipse. And when it's that short, you really see the corona.
And they've learned a lot of things by that, right?
They have, because all stars have corona. And how we learned about stellar corona is through these total solar eclipses. But I don't know about the rest of you that are up there, but I was actually able to see that the corona extended away from the sun by almost 10 degrees. And you only see that great extent when you got a short total solar eclipse. So everybody likes to go to the 7-minute ones, but it's a real treat to go to one that's only 1 or 2 minutes, because that's where you really see the corona. But if you wanted to get pitch dark, where you can see stars, then you got to go to one that's 5, 6, or 7 minutes. So, and hey, 6.5 years from now, there's going to be one that's going to be a little more than 4 minutes. It'll get a lot darker. 2024. And if you want to see one in California, 2045. So put that on your calendar. 2045. There'll be one in California. You'll be 99. Well, a good, you know, what they say is that astronomers have the average longest lifespan of any profession. And it's because they want to stay alive for the next big event. And so they live their lives so they can make it to that. So my staff's already kidding me, saying, Hugh, we know you live the way you do because you want to see the 2045 eclipse. But
so can
that's
you
really
see the
not
photosphere with only a telescope, or can you see it with the when you have the glasses?
Well, I'll show you a few slides. Let me push this up for you. What I did was, because the reporters, we actually had some reporters coming to our event from National Public Radio. And so the one reason because what our group did is we split up. Most of our group went up to this hill that you could drive to. It's about 7,000 feet up, a little more than 7,000 feet. You did something similar here, Tim. It went to a high elevation. So a whole bunch of them went there because they wanted to see the shadow of this of the eclipse come towards them, come over them, and run away from them. Whereas I was down the valley with a bunch of telescopes, but that's where the reporters were going to be. And one of the telescopes I'd set up so that it actually projected the sun's image on a 3 by 3 foot piece of cardboard. And so this is what it looks like on that piece of cardboard at the very beginning of the eclipse. And that was nice because, you know, 40 people could watch it all at once because, you know, only a few people can actually look through the telescopes. But there you can see the sunspots. You know, you see several towards the center of the sun. At the very bottom, you can see them. And that's the beginning of the eclipse. And as it comes down to the bottom, the last thing you see are the disappearing of the sunspots that are at the bottom. And you're watching in real time. It takes about 1 hour to go from first contact to total eclipse. And so while we're waiting, you can actually, if you look at it, in fact, I've got some video clips where you can actually see the moon's shadow moving and then gradually getting past the sunspots that are there.
It moves down?
Yeah, it moves down. So, for example, this is what it looked like about 35 minutes later, where you can see the sunspots at the bottom. And then what's really fun is just before totality, you can actually see the light of the sun being blocked out by mountains that are at the very edge of the moon's surface. So that's why. And if you look carefully, you can actually see there's a little bit of light that extends all the way up here, as well as all the way back here. And you can see these little spots where it goes. And then it went total. When it went total, there wasn't enough contrast on the piece of cardboard, because people think, oh, we're going to be able to see the corona of the cardboard. I said, no, it's not going to happen. As soon as it gets total, look away from the telescope and look up at the sky. And that's one thing we got from the guy, this is where this is fifth eclipse. He says it's a mistake a lot of eclipse watchers make. They try to photograph totality. says it's only 2 minutes. You want to experience it. You don't want to photograph it, because there'll be all kinds of photographs. You really want to look up and experience what's happening here. So that's just before totality, and this one is just after totality. And once again, you can see the craters and mountains of the moon's limb actually giving you some light and dark here. And then this is after the eclipse, and the reporters stayed throughout the entire 2 hours of the eclipse. They were interviewing, and not only me. That was interesting. It was these two women. I think this is the first time they ever had interviewed a Christian astronomer. And their perception was that, you know, science and Christianity are at total odds. There's no way you can reconcile them. But they were stunned when they discovered that it was science that brought me to faith in Christ long before I met Christians. And so they said, can you tell us briefly how that happened? I did. And they said, now we want the long story. And so they said, well, how? I said, tell us about 10. And so they interviewed me, and for about 10 minutes I was explaining how astronomy brought me to faith in Christ. And they said, why did you organize this conference? How can, I mean, it's just a 2-minute eclipse. Why are you guys here for 3 days? And I says, because we're going to be giving talks on how God designed the sun to make possible human civilization, and especially the opportunity for billions of humans to come into a relationship with the creator of the sun and the rest of the universe. And they wanted a synopsis of the talks that were going to be given. And they looked at the telescopes. They took a lot of photographs of all the telescopes. And what was a real treat is there was a telescope there that actually ranks as the largest amateur portable telescope. Dan Bakken, who is the president of our Spokane chapter, he drove his 41.2-inch telescope. The mirror is 41.2 inches in diameter. He drove it to the site, and these two ladies from National Public Radio, they were in awe at that telescope. So, and I said, how come you're not using it for the solar eclipse? The image of the sun would be way too bright. But we were using it for star parties. Says, you have, what? They didn't even know what a star party was. They thought it was a party where you kind of drink and toast the stars. And said, no, that's not exactly what it is. It's where we gather around these telescopes and we look at the wonders of what it says, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God. And the, you know, I'll tell you the treat. I think you'd appreciate this because you've got an 18-inch telescope, right? And I remember looking through your 18-inch telescope at the spiral galaxy M51. Well, you should see M51 through Don Backen's telescope. You have seen it.
Yes.
I mean, you can. The spiral structure comes out in a spectacular way as you look through the eyepiece. And then,
is it colorful too, like the pictures we see, or do they add color to it?
Well, there is color, but it's not as dramatic as what you see in the, because those Hubble Space Telescope photos, they're actually integrating, which means they hold the camera open, not just for a few seconds, but literally for hours.
But those galaxies really are that colorful. They're not like Photoshopped to look.
No, they're not Photoshopped. They really are those colors.
Yeah.
And when you look through it, I mean, again, it's spectacular. Look through Don Backen's telescope. And so.
And where's that large telescope that's in Puerto Rico? What city is it in?
You're probably referring to that 1,000-foot diameter radio telescope. Yeah, it's in Arecibo. And it's no longer the world's largest telescope. The Chinese built one that's 1,600 feet across. They're not using it yet, but it is finished. And they're looking for a director. Well, directing this class is challenging enough. So.
We don't want you to leave. I'm just
kidding. All right.
We don't want you to get pinched.
All right. So. But yeah, totality was spectacular, and it was over before we knew it. But I was trying to explain to people, because it is so short, you get to see something you don't get to see in the longer ones. And hey, if you want to experience one of the longer ones, 2024.
Right.
And once the news got out about our conference, our people in our San Antonio chapter, which is really probably the best spot in the U.S. to see the 2024 one, They're already on it, and they're already getting that organized. So I'll let you know, so because knowing how popular this is, we're going to try to open it up to more than just 150 people. So, but yeah, 10 people in the class here, maybe more, were up there in Oregon to watch it. And a whole bunch of you aren't here. I mean, Ross Hoagland was just so stoked about seeing that total solar eclipse. He wanted to be here to tell you all about it, but he's getting married this weekend. So, and out of state. So I told Ross, you're excused. So,
so could you see the shadows like come in like real fast, 2,000 miles an hour?
Well, that was the expectation, which is why most of our group went up on top of this place that was over 7,000 feet. And they said we could kind of see something, but it's not like, my father saw it when he was living in Alberta. And it was one of these really long ones that was like 7 minutes, and it was perfectly clear, and he could actually see the sharp black disc move towards you at 1,500 miles an hour, come over you. But I think, Tim, you had the best opportunity because you actually saw the shadow go over Mount Jefferson. So I'm going to have Tim get up here again because I think he had the best view of the shadow. Our group basically saw just kind of a blur come towards him and run away. You guys were there. You were on top of the hill, right?
No, we were down below.
You were down below. Okay, that's right. I saw you down there. And Tim, you were up with the group.
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay.
I was just with a group consisting of some family members, and my brother and my sister both live in Eugene, so I just decided years ago I was going to just drive up to their stage at their house, and we'd decide where we were going to go. But we did go up to the top of this Mount Pisgah. It's about 7,000 feet elevation in the National Forest, specifically, so I had a good horizon all the way around through the northwest, through the south, and up through the northeast. And what I did see was not a definite shadow, like you mentioned, but kind of an area that was perhaps maybe that wide angularly that I could see it was dark over here, it was not dark over here, and that just moved right across at about that speed.
Wow.
Across me with a horizon probably 15 miles that I could see clearly.
Wow.
So really fast moving.
2,000 miles an hour, right?
Yeah, it was 2,000 miles an hour. Talk about Mount Jefferson, which was about, roughly 50 miles west of us. The shadow, interestingly enough, the eclipse was in the eastern sky. The shadow approaches from the west, and then the moon comes over. So you've got to be taking your eyes off the eclipse to watch the shadow. Off to the west was Mount Jefferson, which was going to get it shortly before we did where we were. So that was going to be my clue that the shadow is arriving when Mount Jefferson disappeared. Mount Hood, off in the northeast, was outside of the path of totality. And so I watched Mount Jefferson disappear, and then a little while later, the shadow came across us, had this 360-degree bright horizon effect, and Mount Hood was still prominent in the northeast because it didn't get totality. So kind of an interesting perspective on that.
And Tim, you want to switch? Tim, why don't you come up here and just tell us what it was like up on that 7,000?
Here's my totality picture.
Hey, look at that.
I had one telescope set up with
a computer
to automatically take pictures throughout the entire eclipse. I didn't have to touch it at all. I aligned it well enough on Polaris the night before that it tracked perfectly, and the exposures, this automated sequence took one picture every minute throughout the partial phases and then more frequently during totality. And back to 1 minute for the second partial phase. So that I didn't have to fool with the telescope at all. I just had a little spotting scope that I could show the other, about 40 people showed up on the top of the mountain there, and I could show people around. Well, I had a good time.
Yeah, so I went up with the group that went up to the hill, about 100 of us up on the hill. And so the horizon was maybe 5 or 10 miles in one direction, and then behind us where the eclipse was, shadow was coming from, was maybe 1 mile. So we didn't get much time to see anything. It was kind of a blur that came over. But it was awesome being with 100 other people, like waiting for that moment. And as soon as the sliver went away, everybody gasped and looked up, and we all like grabbed each other. And it was just wonderful to be with so many other people there for the exact same experience and happen together. So, yeah.
In fact, maybe I can show you this next week, but one of our people set up a camera just to look at what you're saying, that 360-degree twilight all the way around. Yeah. which is something you only see when you've got a total solar eclipse where the sun is up high in the sky. But he let the camera run, but you could hear everybody talking. And as soon as the totality hit, this big scream went out. And you can actually hear Kathy in the screaming. She was up there. So, well, the funny thing is she was with a whole bunch of single gals, and because you could see the diamond ring effect at the beginning and the diamond ring at the end, and when they saw that diamond ring, they go, a diamond ring, a diamond ring. So her comment was, yeah, it's different when you're a single woman than everybody else. Oh, it's just a diamond ring.
There was a lot of people crying. You could hear it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, if you go on my Facebook page, you can actually, there is a link that goes to this guy's, he got, just like Tim, he got these beautiful photos of totality, and also you get to hear people's responses when they see the eclipse. And yeah, I think, Rick Vargas, who gave a talk, he's the guy, this is his fifth eclipse, he says, yeah, once you've seen one, it's addicting. I like this comment, he says, the difference between seeing a partial solar eclipse and a total solar eclipse is the difference between riding on a commercial airline and jumping out of an airplane. So, or the other comment he made, it's like having a negative pregnancy test and a positive pregnancy test. That's the difference. But I'm going to try to show you. Let me see if I can bring this up here for you. Yeah, here we go. That's that homemade telescope. So, and it gives you an idea of the size of that telescope. There we go.
The largest.
Yeah, largest amateur portable telescope. There are bigger ones that are not portable, but this one you can actually drive around to a really dark site. And in fact, he described how he built that thing and how he's able to get it around as a special vehicle for that. So,
did he tell you why that's the largest and why a bigger one couldn't be made practically?
He did, because it says if you got one where there's light pollution, you can't have an open frame like that, which adds weight. And typically, the mirrors have to be like a 41-inch mirror. You want to be 7 inches thick to prevent the distortion of the glass. And he found a way to mount this in such a way that he didn't get that distortion. But that was the biggest problem in building the telescope, is trying to keep the mirror as thin as it is. And then he talked about how it took him more than a year to grind and to figure the mirror and how he tested it. So he gave a little talk on the building of this telescope. But yeah, as he finished his talk, we all said, yeah, there'll never be a bigger one built than this, given all the trouble he went to just to get this thing up and running. So indeed, quite a challenge to make all that happen. So, okay. And let me try to pull this back here. Okay, all of those of you who saw the total solar eclipse, I think there's six of you here in the class. I'm going to have you come forward here, okay? Or dear, all right. And
no quiz, though, right?
Well, you've got David here. I'm sure David's going, and Tim. David and Tim are going to get all the answers right. But,
no pressure. No.
Oh, and Hope here. Hope was one of the ones that actually transported all the telescopes up to the site. So thank you for doing that. Thank you for keeping them safe. So, Tim, yeah, you're supposed to be up there. And you were up there too. Yeah, come on, let's go. Anybody else? Oh, there's more than 10, because I know there's a whole bunch that aren't here. And you got to see it too? Okay, more, all right. Look at this.
Wallflowers are coming out.
Okay, how many of you viewed it not in Oregon, but somewhere else? Okay, John, where did you go?
Scottsbluff, Nebraska.
Nebraska, wow. And was it cloudy or?
It was absolutely clear.
Absolutely clear.
Yeah, I checked a weather site called Wonderground, and it predicted that. And I was in Colorado on a work trip, and my sister was with me. She wanted to see it, so we left and got there about a couple hours early. We started real early from Colorado Springs. And wandering around, I was thinking of getting away from the city. It would be, you know, kind of open. And she passed. We passed by a zoo, and she wanted to go to the zoo and be with other people. So we went into the zoo. A lot of trees all around. I thought, well, at least we can see up. And but the staff said that they expected the animals to react. The chimpanzees would give alarm calls and so forth. But basically, everything was being calm and quiet, and it got dim, and we saw the peripheral twilight and the beautiful corona. Display, and it was very interesting.
Yeah, well, Rick, who's been to five of these, says the animals only react if the eclipse is more than 4 minutes. Because we're only looking at a 2-minute eclipse, is not long enough.
Yeah, we had a black lab with us. It's a really nice dog. It was a diabetes dog to help this young man for early response. The dog just kind of went under the chair and laid down.
Yeah. Right.
So. I would say we had a dog that was one of these 40 people on top of the mountain who didn't particularly react to anything either. But my previous eclipse in Oregon, which was 1979, there were shadow bands were very prominent at that time. My brother and sister-in-law went from Eugene up to the Columbia Gorge, where it was the path of totality, with his dog. And his dog went absolutely crazy seeing the shadow band. Just didn't know what to do with all of this stuff.
You know, and he's talking about shadow bands about a minute before totality. If you've got one of these moons that covers the sun more than just for a couple of minutes, you get these alternate dark and black shadow bands showing up on the ground and on the walls of buildings. In fact, Rick actually showed us some photos that he's taken of the shadow band, and it moves. So yeah, it's very disturbing to the animals. Birds and animals react when they see those shadow bands moving. But because we're looking at an eclipse that only lasted 2 minutes, there were no shadow bands. However, if you sign up for the one that's being organized by our San Antonio chapter, good chance you're going to see those shadow bands, assuming it's clear. Yes. What causes those bands? It's basically diffraction patterns, because when you got the disk of the moon perfectly covering the disk of the sun, the edge, you get that effect. So, but yeah, you need a longer eclipse to really see that. We all look for it. None of us saw it. And it only lasts a minute, and so you don't want to miss totality. Because a mistake you can make, you can focus on seeing those shadow bands and totally miss the total eclipse. That's the highlight. You want to see that. Okay, a question I got for all of you is if you go to the Christian Broadcasting Network site, they interview me and they interview an atheist astronomer. And the atheist says, she mentioned, this is a perfect solar eclipse where you got the disk of the moon exactly equal to the disk of the sun. And there's no other moon we know of where you get that perfect solar eclipse. And she also admitted that because of these perfect solar eclipses, we learned a lot about our universe that we wouldn't have learned otherwise. But her comment was, it's just a sheer coincidence. And she made no comment because, when I was interviewed, I explained what we do learn from the fact that it's not just an ordinary eclipse, it's a perfect eclipse. And because it's a perfect eclipse, we know things about the universe, and especially about the cosmic creation event, we wouldn't know if we didn't happen to be at a time where we got perfect solar eclipses. And keep in mind, the moon is moving away from the Earth. And it was much closer millions of years ago than it is today. In the future, it's going to be much farther away. What does that mean? We're living at the one time where the disk of the moon equals the disk of the sun in the sky. Both are about half a degree across. And so if God created us earlier, we wouldn't see that. All we would see would be these long total eclipses that would last like 30 minutes to several hours. And if it was in the future, all we see would be the annual eclipses. As it is, over one quarter of all solar eclipses are annular, where you don't get the moon covering up the disk of the sun. So you see this bright light. And when you see that bright light, I mean, for example, that, let me pull this up again for you, where this is literally just seconds. This is just seconds before totality. Literally, we're talking like 15 seconds before totality. Notice you can't see the atmosphere of the sun and you can't see the corona. All you see is that bright little sliver of light. And in order to see the atmosphere and the corona, you have to have it perfectly covering. And if it covers up too much, in fact, these eclipses that last 7 minutes, you basically don't see the corona because it covers up too much of the light of the sun. But the fact that it covered up much smaller, you get to see the corona extending way out.
I'm going to give you a secret about total solar eclipses, and I'm the only person that I know of that's figured this one out. I'm sure other people have, but I figured it out on my own some eclipses ago, that just before totality and just after totality, for up to as much as about 2 to 3 minutes, I don't remember exactly, I've been able to see the corona by sticking my thumb out at arm's length and covering up that sliver of
that
the solar sphere that you can see. And on the other side, you can still see the edge of the moon and the corona. After a couple of minutes, it's just too much intensity and scattered light. You can't do that. And you have to have perfectly clear skies for this to happen. Otherwise, any amount of cloud cover will wipe out that corona. But I've never seen anybody actually document that anywhere. And
wow.
I'm the only person aware that's seen it. But I have seen it, and people I've instructed to do that have been able to see it as well.
You know, Tim, that's the first time I've heard that. I think it'd be great if you'd actually write up like a one-page article. We'll post it on our reasons.org website if you do that. But here's a question I got for you. Do you have to have a perfectly shaped thumb for that to work? Is it just Tim's thumb that makes that happen? So do you have to actually, you know, cut your nails just the right way?
I've actually thought that perhaps a piece, just a piece of a sharp-edged paper or something, but something that doesn't have the reflection or the diffraction right off the edge of my thumb, because I get a bright glow right at the edge of my thumb that kind of interferes with that whole thing. If I had a perfect edge, like a knife edge or something that was non-reflective, I might be able to avoid that and see it even longer.
And I'm wondering, too, if you're actually to put nail polish.
No. Because you're not actually trying to match the radius of the moon. You're simply trying to block out that
just
portion.
Trying to block out this little sliver of light that you see.
Light.
Yeah,
exactly.
Got it. Yeah. Very good. Okay, here's the question. The atheist basically said it's simply a sheer coincidence that we happen to be living at a time where the disk of the moon and the disk of the sun are the same size. There's no design here. How do you refute that? I mean, hey, you heard 4 lectures. So do any of you remember what you heard? Why that wouldn't work? I mean, 4 of you here heard the lectures. Yeah, go ahead, Tim.
Well, I mean, I don't know how exactly I'd refute that, but I'd bring up what it's done for us, that it's essentially proven, or at least it was the first step that really launched general relativity into fame, into becoming a well-established theory, because Einstein could see the bending of the light around the sun, and he wouldn't have been able to do that without a perfect solar eclipse like that.
That's
so
right.
That it's just, there was so much important stuff that came from that.
Yeah, part of the talks we gave in the conference was how Einstein published his theory of general relativity in 1917, and Sir Arthur Eddington, a British mathematician, in 1918, organized an expedition to Brazil to see one of these longer eclipses. And with a longer eclipse, you can see stars all the way around the sun. I mean, we could see Venus, we could see Mercury. Some of us tried to see the star Regulus. We really couldn't do it because of how bright the corona was. But when you get one of these longer ones, you can see stars all the way around. It was Einstein's theory that said, if my theory is right, you're going to notice that the positions of those stars are not the same as when there is no eclipse there. Because his theory predicted that the gravity of the sun would bend the light of the more distant stars. And Sir Arthur Eddington was able to make measurements with that 1918 solar eclipse and showed that the prediction that Einstein made was correct. And he actually boasted If it wasn't for me organizing that eclipse, nobody in the world would even know who Albert Einstein is. I'm the one that launched him to worldwide fame. A little more of his ego was brought a little later when he said, only two people in the world really understand the theory of general relativity, and I'm not too sure about the other guy. So, really arrogant. He began his life as an atheist, was quite opposed to Big Bang cosmology because it didn't make the universe old enough to sustain Darwinian evolution. He said, whatever illusions the biologists have, we mathematicians and physicists know, if you want to make Darwinism work, you need a minimum of a quadrillion years. And Big Bang cosmology didn't allow for that. But guess what launched Big Bang cosmology? The theory of general relativity. That's when astronomers first recognized if general relativity is true, the universe has a beginning, and it's a relatively recent beginning, only billions of years ago. That all happened thanks to the 1918 solar eclipse. But there's more. Now, Tim, you're going to explain a little bit more. What else do we learn from solar eclipses?
Oh, I've been talking a lot. Someone else wants to
Well, we got David, the physicist here. I'm sure he could talk about it.
I think there was. We learned about the corona.
Right. Yeah, if it wasn't for a total solar eclipse, today astronomers might not even have any idea that stars have corona. We saw it first with the sun thanks to a total solar eclipse. And yeah, I mean, when they first began to examine these corona, they were amazed at how far away from the stars they extend. And what that did is it enabled astronomers to actually build a detailed atmospheric model for the sun. And they recognized in studying other stars that other stars must behave the same way. And that basically led to detailed understanding of the interior of stars and the burning history of stars, which proved to be a very powerful confirmation of the Big Bang creation model. The fact that our understanding of the history of stars is identical to understanding of the history of the universe as described by Big Bang cosmology. And incidentally, that congruence only happened around 2002, 2005. That was the year when finally they were able to resolve the conflict between astrophysics and cosmology. But what really made that happen was our observations of total solar eclipses.
One of the other things, as far as the refutation idea, that if you just look at basically, okay, we're lucky that we got a moon the right size and the right distance to do this, and we're the only place that even comes close to this. I mean, no other satellite we know of has any degree of closeness to that kind of a thing. But also look at the other, they say it's a coincidence. Well, look at other coincidences that are relating to that. The fact that this period of time when we can see these solar eclipses has only occurred in the entire history of the Earth right now when we have advanced civilization technology to be able to benefit from it and learn from it as well. And there are other coincidences as well. So you take one coincidence, you add it to another one, suddenly the probability of that goes way, way down and becomes much less convincing.
Right. Okay, because the error that atheist astronomer is making, she was only looking at one coincidence.
Right.
Okay, she says, yeah, just the fact that they're the same size. But as Tim here has pointed out, there's no other satellite where it even comes close to being the same. I mean, we know of 178 satellites in our solar system, and none of them come anywhere close to where they're about the same size by a country mile.
That is just
Well, I think she would, because my guess is she's only looking at one coincidence.
Right.
You know, as Tim here has just pointed out, there's another coincidence. There's only one time in the history of the sun where the sun's luminosity is stable enough that we can have global human civilization. And also, as he was pointing out, it's thanks to global human civilization we're actually able to appreciate the significance of these total solar eclipses. I mean, if you don't have telescopes, it's just not the same. So, yeah, she missed the coincidence that there's only one time in the history of the sun where we humans can exist, and it happens to be the same time that we got these perfect solar eclipses. It also happens to be identical to that narrow time window when you got grains that can live here. You know, the entire history of the earth, there's only a narrow time window when you can have productive grains. Think about how much of our civilization is dependent on rice, on oats, on wheat, millet,
corn.
If we didn't have those grains, there's no way we could have a large population with high technology. We wouldn't be able to feed our cattle, for example, and get all the meat from them that we do. And it also happens to be identical to the time window when we got the animals that we need to launch civilization. Again, if you look at the history of the Earth, there's a very narrow time window in which you can have large mammals and birds. And without those, we wouldn't be able to launch civilization. Can you guys name a couple more?
I
was going to say, just following on to that, if this period where the moon and sun are just perfect size had happened 10,000 years ago, we in modern civilization would not have been able to benefit from that at all. We would have seen paintings on caves and that sort of thing, and not known what to do with it.
Right. Yeah, go ahead.
How long will we be able to see this?
I think a few thousand, I don't know.
Okay, well, what's going to happen as we move into the future? A greater and greater percentage of these eclipses will be annular. Right now, about 25 to 30% of them are annular. As we move into the future, that's going to become 50%, 60%, and eventually 100%. And then we're going to lose the benefit of being able to learn science from these eclipses. Now, it's going to take a while before it's 100%. Why? Because the orbit of the moon around the Earth is not a perfect circle. And so there's times when it's closer to us and farther away. And the moon is moving at a rate of about 4 centimeters per year away from the Earth. So it'll be a few million more years before you won't see any total solar eclipses at all. But it's a shorter period of time where the percentage of annular eclipses begins to be a problem. And so, for example, our capacity to see 7-minute long total solar eclipses, that's going to disappear. We're going to be seeing shorter ones. And that means there's less of an opportunity to do science. On the other hand, we now have the technology where we can put astronomers in an airplane that flies at twice the speed of sound. And when you're flying at twice the speed of sound, you get to keep up with the eclipse. And so you get to experience a total solar eclipse that lasts for a whole hour. But it means you've got to be up about 50,000 feet and you got to be flying at more than twice the speed of sound in order to keep up with the movement of that eclipse. But I've actually known astronomers have done that. And they said, yeah, if you've got an hour to collect data, you can get a lot of data. But again, that means you have to be living in a time where that kind of technology is even feasible. Okay, I'll give you one more. One more is, notice we got these perfect solar eclipses at the time window when we don't have any nearby supernova eruptions. And again, that's critical for sustaining civilization. And that time window, we're talking, is just 10,000 years wide. And so when you add up all the coincidences, I don't think it's a coincidence. God wanted us to be able to see these perfect solar eclipses, to be able to see them with the technology so we can learn about the physics and the astronomy that declares there must be a God beyond the heavens that created everything. Dave is standing up, which means I'm out of time. But Steve, you had a quick comment.
Yeah. Check it out. I think it might be interesting for the class if it's true. If I understand the corona, it's actually a good part of it is material flowing away from the sun that makes the solar wind, which ends up hitting our magnetic sphere of the Earth and at the poles developing the north and south lights.
It is, and here's something else. That corona tells you that there's a solar wind that blows strong enough to protect us from deadly cosmic radiation. Our planet Earth, here's another coincidence. Our planet Earth happens to be just the right distance from the sun where the solar wind is equal to the cosmic wind. So they basically balance one another out, which means we get exposed to the minimum amount of deadly radiation from the sun and deadly radiation from cosmic rays. So as you leave this class today, you might want to thank God for the fact that He put our planet at just the right distance from our sun and created the sun in such a way that it blasts out a wind that's strong enough to protect us from deadly cosmic rays, but not so strong as to kill us.
So, Van Allen belts help.
Van Allen belts help, yeah. A lot of good reasons to thank God. And that was my really motivation coming to class today. I really want you to leave here praising God for the fact that we actually live at a time where you got perfect solar eclipses, and that what we learn from these perfect solar eclipses gives us dozens more reasons to thank God for what he did, which means he really must have a purpose for you living at this time. It's more than just being able to enjoy these eclipses. We want you to discover why you're here. Okay, I'm out of time. I'm going to quickly close in prayer. But you know, I'm just thrilled how many of you got to see that total solar eclipse. And for those of you that missed it, 2024 is coming up. April, I think it's what, April 18th, we're going to have. They passed their quiz. They did great. Thank you.
Or Uruguay in 2019.
Oh. Yeah, if you want to go to Uruguay. So, but hey, if you're on a budget like I am, you might want to wait for San Antonio. All right. Father in heaven, we thank you for this very special privilege of living at a time in the history of our planet and our solar system where we get to see these perfect solar eclipses and be awed by the beauty and the elegance of what we see, but also be grateful for what we're able to learn from these total solar eclipses that really declares the glory and majesty and righteousness of our Creator. Lord, we praise you for what you've done and helped us to learn. And Lord, I pray to you, give us many opportunities, because people are still talking about this eclipse. I don't know if any eclipse has gotten as much attention as this one. Lord, as we have more opportunities this next week and the next, Lord, I pray you equip us to use this as a way to guide people into a relationship with Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you.